Welcome to another edition of the Insurance AUM Journal podcast. My name is Stuart Foley, and I'll be your host, standing with you at the corner of insurance and asset management with an old friend of mine, Nico Santini, CIO at ProSight. Welcome, Nico.
How you doing, Stuart?
I'm good.
Great to connect again.
Yeah, thank you. It's good. We've gotten through some audio issues, and we're all up to speed. We've got weather in Nico's area in Connecticut, and bright and sunny here in Chicago. So Nico and I, full disclosure to our audience, Nico and I have known each other for a really long time, and we both run money for insurance companies for a long time. And so I want to talk a little bit about how we first met at your former firm, New England Asset Management. You were a portfolio manager. You worked your way up, right, as a junior guy, kind of as a backup. You became a senior guy. You became running some of the firm's most important relationships. And recently, you've switched sides and become a chief investment officer. Can you talk a little bit about how that transition has been and how your background lends itself to what you're doing today?
Yeah, that's a great question, Stu. And, first and foremost, I'm happy we're able to connect. You know, we haven't been able to talk for a while. It's good to see you across from the mic, so to speak, video-wise. So always great to be here. But, you know, a good starting point would be, could you bring up a good point about when you're in the third-party asset management business, it's very different from being a CIO, right? You're talking about managing clients' assets from afar and not doing it internally. And the point I was going to make is that if you think about kind of what my career has really developed from New England Asset Management all the way over to ProSight, is that if I think about New England Asset Management, you hit it on the head. You know, they were able to provide that kind of that learning experience and culture that was able to build up my credentials to, you know, not only be in front of board of directors, but also senior management and also be able to communicate messages. And when you think about the transition, in fact, it's been pretty easy. It's been pretty seamless. And the reason being is that, you know, the credentials that I build up over time about first leading from trading securities, then going into research, and then going into portfolio management, it really builds kind of the stepping stones to eventually, I think, become a chief investment officer and really build up that knowledge base. Credentials are really can flow through in a dynamic way. And the step for me has been seamless. After, you know, managing money on a third party basis and working with between 10 and 15 clients every day and, you know, almost close to $10 billion, it's an easier step to make because, as you mentioned, you know, you're focusing on not only, you know, one client now, which is ProSight, which is fantastic, is now I get a full the capability to fully build out the, you know, the product and the philosophy and the strategy, tactical asset allocation, but it's really bringing it into fuller focus. And I wouldn't necessarily say that it's easier to be in a CIO role rather than...
I would. I would. The whole thing about like that whole like make more money, work less thing, I think, you know, it's a good trade. Let's be honest.
But here's well said, but... here's one of the things to think about is that what was easier, I would say, with working as a third-party manager with 15 clients was that you only had a conduit into one person. So you manage one portfolio and you always talk to the CFO or CIO or the treasurer.
Yeah.
And the beauty of that is that when you can use them as a screening mechanism, right? You ask them a question, you ask them for, you know, can you give us, you know, a yes or no on a solution that I'm putting in front of you? And they would come back and say yes or no. Whereas now, what the beauty of, and I think the challenge as well at ProSight is that,
yeah,
you know, I'm the one answering those questions. And by the way, in order to answer the question, I need to go to the CFO, head of finance, the treasurer, my investment accounting folks, my tax folks, and I need to gather the herd together to have the conversation before I can actually come up with an answer of yes or no. So it is a little bit more challenging from that facet, whereas before I would argue to say it was actually easier because you had that one conduit.
Right.
So that's been a little bit of a change that I'm starting to acclimate to. And frankly, it's extremely challenging. But the beauty is that you were able to really integrate yourself with the organization. You're able to understand what all the how all the parts move and how they all fit together. And it's really been able to allow me to build up some credentials internally with the firm. So as Joe and others in our communication area could ascribe to, you know, it's been a great learning experience over the last 8 months. And it's been a great way to really acclimate myself to the organization.
Well, it's interesting. I know that you'll be probably traveling less. I guess we all are. But once we're able to travel more freely, I'm thinking that you might be traveling a little less. So differences, you talked about internal versus external. And it always gets down to, you know, if you look at the insurance industry, $7 trillion in total assets, over two of that is outsourced. People talk about the CAGR on outsourced assets. I mean, that number was $1 trillion less not that long ago. What do you think about managing money internally versus externally, and why would you go external if you do?
Right, right. It's, you know, that's something I've thought about for a long time. And, you know, the baseline for that is, let's face it, I worked for a third-party asset manager. And what I saw from that angle is that, you know, offering competitive product at a very competitive price is a no-brainer for a lot of insurance companies. What I always struggled with is that, so let's conversely think about, you know, my role as a CIO. You know, do I build it? Do I buy it? Do I rent it? And from a CIO level with a company of our size, we have about $2.5 billion and we're growing. You know, I can't see us really doing things internally. When you have the likes of the PIMCOs of the world, the GSAMs, the New England Asset Managements, and other firms who do a spectacular job of core management. Now, one thing that I've been thinking about and I've been having conversations with internally here is that it's highly cost effective to outsource. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that, especially for core assets. Now, if you think about specialty assets, oftentimes you think about these specialty managers out there who do really good things within their slices of the market. You know, instead of building it internally, there are certainly managers out there who you can hire at competitive fees and get you some really good risk-adjusted returns. One thing I've been thinking about internally is that not building it, but nonetheless, when you're investing in these third-party managers, look to potentially not only just give them assets, but also potentially buy an equity stake in them. Now, the reason why I bring that up is because that's kind of a crossover from direct internal and direct outsourcing. So I think there could be this mechanical nature of the market where we've seen this from a couple of firms over the years who have put a lot of money with certain asset managers and then have taken an equity stake. And the beauty of that is you're really upping your risk-adjusted returns because not only are you getting returns on the assets they're investing, but also you're getting an equity component, which is equity upside with the growth. I truly do think that internal management is, you know, it's becoming less apparent at firms. As you mentioned, third-party asset management is growing. I think that's going to continue and the trend's going to continue. And in fact, you know, the trend's going to continue because firms have gotten better at it too. They're doing a very effective cost, providing very good effective cost solutions. And they're actually providing more service and they're providing more product at better competitive pricing. So I think the wave is still going, kind of coming in terms of that third-party asset management taking place and continually forming over the upcoming years.
So I think that's a really good point. I mean, you know, outsourcing assets, it is, and you and I have both seen the behind the scenes only at one firm. In my own seat today, I see it from a number of different firms, but the level of resources that insurance asset management firms can bring to bear is significant, and it's cost prohibitive, it's resource prohibitive to do that internally without a tremendous amount of scale, right? And at least that, I mean, that's one person's opinion. You mentioned something a little different about internal versus external, just in terms of your perspective, right? And strategic versus tactical plans. One of the things about you being the person that says yes or no is you own that decision and you own it for a long time potentially, right? So How do you work in your strategic and tactical plans? And oh, by the way, I don't envy you in any way of trying to having to manage money in this environment. So with that big mess of a question, take it away.
Yeah, thanks for that, Stu. That's, you know, I would hope that you wouldn't have asked that question.
Because, that's a Gordian knot of insurance asset management questions right there.
It is. I guess if you have another hour and a half, I could probably extrude you through my philosophy and thought process. But, you know, simplistically said, and as simplistically as I can say it, is that, you know, the strategic asset allocation that, you know, we employ, which is, you know, a philosophy that really leverages off of each one of our core managers. Because as I mentioned, core managers, you can get them at a very effective cost. And also they've got a lot of services out there that they can help you with. So the way that I've always thought about it is that why would I want to build a strategic asset allocation model? Why would you ever want to build it internally when you have folks that have been doing it for 10, 20, 30 years and they're really good at it? You're not going to be able to build a model that's any better. I can guarantee you that, because they have more resources and I'm not going to hire two people to do it because it's going to cost me $1 million. So I think from a strategic asset allocation level, leveraging off the systems, the capabilities, the manpower that these outsourced managers have, I think is an incredible utilization of resources, and it creates efficiencies that you can never gain internally. And that's my firm belief. Now, what I would say is that from a tactical asset allocation belief is that philosophically, I think that we can do things from a tactical basis, meaning I could direct managers to do certain things, right, within my core assets. I can give certain managers who do alternative channels of assets some additional money. So that's more tactical, and I could do it pretty quickly and fluidly. But one thing that, and we could talk about this later, is that what COVID and the GFC taught me, COVID environment and GFC, is that, and I've known this for a while, is that you need to be highly tactical. So you set up your strategic goals, you set up your directional output, you know where you can go, you know where you have your capacity, but really where you can make really good money and do well is from a tactical basis. And what I'm learning and what we just instituted is that we're using ETFs. We're starting to use ETFs much more readily. We've got a capacity of X, whereas we had a capacity of zero, a couple quarters ago.
Yeah.
And I think that by using ETFs and using them very fluidly within various segments of the fixed income market and equity markets, obviously, that you can pick up extra alpha. You could do it from a, let's say, a group of one, which I am. I'm a CIO that doesn't have anyone else working with me. And it can be very methodical, and it really parlays nicely into a strategic approach and bringing it down to a tactical level. Because then you could really attribute the alpha very quickly to your portfolio as you make these trades through these efficient products. And I like that. And, you know, it's one thing that, you know, I never used to like ETFs up until this year, for the very reason that I was never in the seat and never seen how quickly the markets have reacted. And I mean, snap back. They certainly didn't in the GFC. This time it did. And I wish that I had the tool set at the time. So the ETF strategy has really been parlayed into a nice, what I would call a philosophical approach from my end, and what we've been talking to the board about to actually initiate.
I think it's a really interesting point because, you know, we've heard from some other folks about how the change in liquidity in the market during the COVID drawdown, you know, that ETFs did pretty well in that environment. And it's interesting. I mean, we hadn't talked about that before this call, but, you know, it's interesting that you're taking advantage of that. From an investor, it makes a lot of sense, right? It makes a lot of sense to me, but I'm not implementing it, right? You are implementing it. So I think that's really interesting.
Well, one other thing, Stu, is that now we're a public company. So, you know, when you're implementing an ETF strategy, they get treated as equities. It doesn't matter if it's fixed income. They get treated as equities on our income statement. So it does create some volatility. But the way that I look at it is that as long as you just partition off a small part of your portfolio for the ETF strategy, it'll be enhancing to your after-tax returns and investment income potentially, and it won't create a lot of volatility. Now, that being said, the reason why, which really catalyzed that whole ETF strategy, was that, and I know a lot of managers and a lot of CIOs had this issue, is that we had core managers who are very good at what they do. I've got three of them, very top of the line folks. They do a great job. The problem is they couldn't find enough bonds, right? So I said, go out and buy me 100 million of non-agency RMBS. Guess what? They can only buy 25 million. Okay, go out and buy corporate triple Bs. Well, guess what? They couldn't find enough. It was so competitive, and actually the market reacted so quickly. So the way I thought about it is we were missing out and they were only able to enact about 25% of my strategy. Whereas if I just let them go to buy bonds individually in each one of those markets and say, go for it, this is where I think the alpha is, they go and do that. And then for the 75%, I utilize ETFs. I can do that instantaneously.
Yeah, it's a great point.
There's a little give and take there because, you know, they could buy, I'm not just buying the general market, but they buy the specific bonds, which probably have less volatility. So I think the combination of the two really does enhance a portfolio diversification, the perspective and overlaying a tactical asset allocation.
How do you see markets trending, volatility? Are you building dry powder, private, public? What do you see at 50,000 feet?
Yeah, I think, you know, my thought process about the markets are probably not going to be dissimilar to many folks out there. So if you talk to and survey 10 CIOs or investment managers out there, they're going to say, you know, the markets are going to be choppy, right? For a variety of reasons, one of which is sitting right in front of us, which is the election. Two is that, you know, the interplay between the U.S. and China and the relations we have, how is that going to gin out over the course of the next few years? And then obviously COVID and all the implications there and the fiscal policy, monetary policy, all of these things are really going to create some form of volatility. Now, I can't say directly, is it going to be equity volatility or fixed income volatility? Is it going to be down the stack or up the stack, public, privates? But what I can tell you that volatility will certainly be much more present in the marketplace than we've ever seen. And we've already started to see it spike up. Now, that being said, when I think about our portfolio, what we've been focusing on and wholeheartedly focusing on is that I firmly believe that the public markets are just there, even though spreads are wide right now, they're still just, you know, they are liquid. You can find some opportunities, but there's not a lot of opportunities out there. One. Two is that you're not being compensated. So the risk adjusted returns are just not, they're just not there. So what we're doing in our portfolios, we're, you know, again, kind of similar to a lot of folks. And I hate to say that because you never want to follow the pack. But we are moving away from public markets going into private markets because you are picking up a incremental investment income and yield, even with the expense overlay of hiring a manager to do so. And I really like that trade because, you know, we're not a life company, we're a PNC company, but I'm still looking for the additive incremental investment income and yield in my portfolio. Very few places to do that. The only place to really do that is in private markets. And so we have facilitated a sleeve of our portfolio into private markets, and it's not just corporate privates. I really like the structured securities private market and ABS privates, and I also like infrastructure. And I think the combination of all three of those within privates are going to be a nice, what I would call, one, diversification element to our portfolio, two, downside protection. And then three, which is kind of a trifecta, is not only you get diversification and income, but you also can get ESG benefits, right? Because the infrastructure, solar, whatever it might be, is going to give me some ESG. And there are also some other nuances around there where we hire two private managers who are going to be implementing a bit of ESG on that. So I like that, what I call the trifecta of investing, which is, again, diversification, income or total return, and ESG. I think if you could find assets in that part of the markets, I think you do it. You do it. I don't necessarily think you do it aggressively, but I think that you do it to a degree which is noticeable, and you can convey a message to the board, investment committee, and also rating agencies and others out in the marketplace. So that's where I see the opportunity for the most part. I do not see opportunity in corporate bonds. We're moving away. We had a very high allocation and started the whole process of moving that down pretty dramatically because of where we were in the economic cycle, but also similar to what I just mentioned is that we just don't think there's a lot of value there. And in fact, you know, a lot of our peers already have lower corporate bond positions and we're moving down towards it. Not that the peers are right, but I think for our business and how our liquidity profile is forming and our liabilities, that even adding these private securities with illiquid tendencies is still a fit for us. And I think that a lot of insurance companies are finding that out, they're pursuing it, and they're executing on those strategies.
It's interesting that you bring up ESG because we just became UNPRI signatories just this week. And part of what we're doing is partnering with them to increase participation by insurance companies. So I've talked to other CIOs who also have ESG at the top of their priority list as well. So here comes a knuckleball at you that we haven't talked about, and I ask all of our guests this question. You have kids that are nearing college age, and I teach. I've taught as a professor full-time for the last couple of years, and I teach now as an adjunct. And the job market went from going great guns, where students had multiple offers, and then it went dark, right? And a lot of folks had their internships pulled. A lot of people had their offers pulled. I get conversations from students, emails from students saying, you know, what do I do? What, you know, what I'm looking for this, I'm looking for that. So what I'd like you to do is take yourself back to when you walked across the stage at your college graduation and you now could talk to you then. What would you tell your 21-year-old self?
That's, I'm trying to remember, did I walk or crawl across the stage? I couldn't remember.
We're not talking GPA. We're just talking that you made the trip.
That's right. Yeah, we certainly don't want to go down that path. So let's stick to the topic. It's been a very, very, I've thought about this a lot, actually. And the reason why is because I've been hyper engaged in my alma mater, Bryant University, hyper engaged with them. So I'm on the alumni council. I'm on the Wall Street Council. I'm on the board that manages the fixed income endowment portion of the portfolio that's managed by the student. So I've had many, many conversations and I've thought about it a lot. So what I would say is that the ability to interact with alumni and potential employers, I would say, is arguably at the highest level it's ever been. So you have the opportunity through Zoom, through conference calls to interact with alumni, because in fact, I'd argue to say that alumni are much more interactive with the communities that are out there. You know, one, because they're actually donating a lot more. They're at the age in which they're donating, and there's kind of this hump in terms of, you know, the retirees. So folks have time in their hands where they're advocating for helping the university and the students. And so things have changed in a better way because you can communicate more fluidly, you can communicate more effectively with potential companies that could hire and people who might have an interest in you. And case in point here, so what's happened with me is that I give a good amount of presentations to the Bryant community and work with a couple of these alumni communities within Bryant. And what I've found is that I've been getting pinged through LinkedIn and even Facebook, but not that that's the most appropriate leverage point. But immediately after I have these web calls, people are contacting me, and these are students. And
absolutely,
I love it because you know, they need to understand, and I give students who do that an amazing amount of credit because one, they're being incredibly proactive. Two, they're breaking down the barrier of being shy to, you know, have this cold communication point. And when I see kids do that, I give them check marks and I say, okay, these are kids who I should probably continue the conversation because they're aggressive, they're proactive, and they understand how to utilize all the tools. And think about that as from an employer standpoint. You want people like that, right?
Absolutely.
So I think it's gotten the market. Yes, it's a challenging market, but I think the tools are there and the communication links are there for students to really reach out to formulate a strategy to get in front of people, because there are people like me who I would love to talk to students all the time. Well, I would love it. And I love when they communicate with me. So they should always use those leverage points.
It's a point that I try to make with students, which is use your resources, right? You're on a call, I teach a class, whatever, and I'll have two or three students reach out to me on LinkedIn and want to connect. And the other 40 won't. And you go, well, you know, use your resources, right? That's one thing. And the other thing that you mentioned is really, really important. And, you know, despite being the Joe Rogan of insurance asset management podcasting, I'm not exactly sure how big our reach is, right? But I am going to call out universities and colleges right now. You said at Bryant that there's a student-managed component of the endowment, right? Here's my in-your-face, not your face, in the college and university community's face. If you are producing students out of your business schools that you think are good and well-prepared to go out into the job market, then let them manage some of your money and put your money where your mouth is. There's plenty of qualified people like you who are willing to help oversee that process and get those students hands-on running money. It's not the same as running a paper portfolio or some sort of esoteric exercise. Let those students run money. They'll be more competitive in the job market. They'll have a better set of experiences. And it's good for everybody. And I really, in all sincerity, applaud you for your efforts at Bryant. And I know there are lots of other people who are in senior positions at other insurance companies who do the same kind of work. But I've known you for a long time. You're a good friend. And, you know, I just really want to applaud your efforts there.
Yeah. And to that point, Stu, you know, it's very important. I want to pull on one string that you that's kind of hanging there and try to unpack that. One thing you said, which is it doesn't require a lot of resources for the school to release funds out of the endowment, which, face it, I mean, there's, you don't need much. Starting with $250,000, starting with $100,000, starting with, you know, we've got $1 million and change. It's pretty small.
Right.
But the key component is that, one, it gets the students very excited because they're tangentially touching that endowment money and they're learning about that process and they're investing. But also, from my perspective, is that, so I provide oversight. It's very similar. We set out an IPS and guidelines, which, by the way, they put together, and we just ratify. It's exactly like giving them the bounds, right? They can't really do. They can't. So once you have the guidelines, give them the guidelines and man the ship, do what you need to do. And if you need to breach those guidelines and expand your capacity, let's have a conversation. It's exactly the way we talk about it with a board, right? If I've got additional ideas and solutions I want to give to the board, I talk to them about it. I give them the ups and the negatives, the positives, and we work through it and we decide. Exact same thing. It's very easy to do. Yeah. It's just you do need alumni engagement and you need somebody as a professor to really shepherd that process. And we've been very fortunate to have that.
Yeah, it's true. So I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your day to speak with us. And it's great to catch up. And I'm very happy to see you being so successful. I know that ProSight's going to benefit from you joining there very much.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it, Stu. And as always, let's keep the connection going and hope to hear from you soon.
Thank you. That concludes this edition of the Insurance AUM Journal podcast. If you like us, follow us. If you have ideas, you can email us at podcast@insuranceaum.com. My name is Stuart Foley. I'm your host, and this is the Insurance AUM Journal podcast.